KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and I'm rounding out a fellowship at Princeton Center for Information Technology Policy. Welcome to, amazingly, the first show of 2017 on Hearsay Culture. I had several months where I was focusing on preparing and then teaching, and I think it went pretty well, a new course in privacy law, as well as working on some other writing projects, and of course focusing my attention, as many people are, on the state of our democracy and our government, and working in that direction. However, Hearsay Culture remains a high priority, and so I'm very happy today to return to the air, and I'll be recording and airing several new shows in the coming weeks. My first guest, therefore, for 2017 is, as a return guest, Professor David Galumbia of Virginia Commonwealth University, author of the recent book, The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism, which was published by the University of Minnesota Press last year, 2016. This, it turns out, to be an exceptionally timely project, given the state of our democracy, and particularly the seeming rise of right-wing and alt-right, which I will use advisedly, speech and politics. And in David's book, he takes a look at a topic which has not gotten a lot of attention in this context, although broadly it has, which is cryptocurrencies and particularly Bitcoin. We have focused on Bitcoin on Hearsay Culture several times over the past several years, having on scholars like Arvind Narayanan from Princeton to talk about what cryptocurrencies are. We've also had conversations broadly about the nature of these new libertarian-esque forms of e-commerce and what they mean for technology as well as intellectual property law. But David's focus is something quite different and fairly unique and something which I think is worthy of significant discussion, which is what we're going to do today. In Bitcoin, and particularly the language around Bitcoin, David argues that what we're seeing from Bitcoin proponents as well as from the community is the kind of language and thinking that came through and has been propagated, as he writes, almost exclusively by far-right groups like the Liberty League, the John Birch Society, the militia movement, and the Tea Party, conspiracy theorists like Alex Jones and David Icke, and to a lesser extent, rightist outlets like Fox Media and some right-wing politicians. This is therefore a topic which is obviously controversial in the sense that I imagine, and that many proponents of Bitcoin would say to David in response, and it's a question I will ask him, that's ridiculous. On the other hand, David makes a very strong case for the parallels between Bitcoin rhetoric and practice, right, and the nature of right-wing extremism, everything from a rejection of the traditional banking system to how software itself is created and propagated. And so throughout this book, David really pushes us, and I think appropriately, to think about more broadly the nature of technology rhetoric and our understandings and beliefs in technology and what they mean for our democracy and for our society today. This show is being recorded on May 31st, 2017, and it is my wish and hope that years from now, folks will be able to look back at this time and this fraught time in American history and see that we went through some very difficult months, hopefully not years, but came out of it in a stronger position as a democracy and as a society that's both pluralistic and also intelligent. As I sit here today and as we're about to begin this conversation with David, I don't know what the outcome will be, but I think David's contribution here in thinking about particularly language and practice around these issues is incredibly important. And so I'm delighted to have David on the show. By way of a little bit more background, David teaches in the English department and the media art and text PhD programs at VCU. He had been previously on Hearsay Culture regarding his book, The Cultural Logic of Computation, and he's a very prolific author and scholar, and he blogs at Uncomputing, that's uncomputing.org. David is joining us via Skype, I'm assuming, from somewhere at or near VCU. So, David, thank you for returning to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So, Dave, let me start off here because like as I mentioned in the introduction, I think your work is really interesting, important, and pretty unique. Tell us a bit more about your background for those that aren't familiar and why you came to write particularly this book, The Politics of Bitcoin.
I, as we probably talked about last time, I did work for about a decade in the financial information technology sector on Wall Street for a technology company that mostly served what they call the sell side in investment banking, the people who put together bond offerings. And although I got that job through just having both being able to write, but which turns out to be pretty necessary in the world of technology, as many people will tell you when they're inside it, but also because of my background in computers. So I found that I had to learn about finance, which I knew very little about. And, you know, over the course of a decade, I learned a fair amount about it. And, you know, I, as we also talked about last time, I'm really interested in the politics of digital culture. So that's something I keep an eye on. And when Bitcoin started to come around, you know, it was just something to notice. And, you know, I didn't really pay that much attention to it at first, except that I noticed it was supposed to be a financial product. So that, you know, at least put my antenna up. And then when, you know, when the first run of Bitcoin surging in value, you know, going from worth virtually nothing to a dollar, which was, a you know, percentage-wise an enormous change, and then eventually to $300 and $900 and in the first run up to something like $1,200, I started to pay attention to what people were saying about it, and I was really stunned because what they were saying was very familiar stuff to me from just coming to learn basic facts about finance, right? And what I was stunned by was what was being offered was stuff that on Wall Street is considered conspiracy theory, you know, discredited conspiracy theory. Now, there are a few people who are usually called gold bugs, right? And they are people who sell precious metals, and some of them are taken somewhat seriously, but in general, they are by, you know, major investment banks, by most responsible analysts and investors, they are considered cranks, essentially. And, you know, I hadn't, despite my interest in right-wing politics, I hadn't really investigated what was going on with those people all that carefully until the Bitcoin stuff started to happen. And then I went and started reading sort of the history of who is it that says gold is like this perfect investment and all, you know, paper money is fiat money that is terrible. And you start to read into that, and it has a pretty dark and unpleasant history. And it is firmly rooted in, as you mentioned in your quoting from my book, the John Birch Society and the Liberty League and a lot of people who were just promoting a very dark and frankly often anti-Semitic, right? I mean, this stuff goes very far back in history, and the one of the phrases you even see right now in Bitcoin, right, is the Rothschild banking conspiracy. You know, and this is a view that really started in the late 19th century. The Jewish bankers from England were controlling America's economy, and you see that today, right? I mean, it's anyway. So the more I paid attention to Bitcoin, the more I saw this stuff coming up, even where people seem to not be trying to sell these conspiracy theories, right? They seem to think that they were offering very straightforward and maybe even just purely technological recommendations about why Bitcoin would be beneficial, but if you were familiar with the conspiracy discourses that circulate around gold and other things, you could just see it, you know, all over the place in what people said.
So, David, so you said a lot there, and of course, I was listening, as is my wont, rather than interjecting. And I want to come back to particularly the anti-Semitic strain that you've identified. Perhaps I should ask this, though, up front, particularly for listeners who may have heard what you said and thought that's pretty wild. So let me kind of dispense with this. And it's not the most important question, but I think it's good for context. So just based upon your response here, is it your understanding understanding, and I don't want to even say belief, because that I think implies to some degree a lack of rigor in the work, which I don't think exists based upon my read of the book. Is it your belief that there's a certain percentage of those that espouse, and we'll talk about this idea, kind of believe in Bitcoin, right, are themselves anti-Semites, or is it more a matter of rhetoric? And of course, recognizing that you could easily say, well, I don't know these people, but I'm curious how far you take that critique. In other words, the use of the you know, at this point, old canard of Jewish bankers controlling the world's economy, as epitomized by the Rothschilds. Do you believe that is a fundamental tenet or belief of many people that espouse Bitcoin, or does it reflect something else?
It interests me in large part because I don't think most of the people involved in Bitcoin are conscious anti-Semites, and I think most people involved in Bitcoin would actually dispute the Rothschild banking conspiracy theory thing, right? They would say they don't believe that. At the same time, if you go on Twitter and other places in social media, those people who, as we know, are really rampant today, who do still talk about that stuff, are a lot of them are really into Bitcoin. So the Venn diagram between people who believe in the Rothschild banking conspiracy and Bitcoin promoters is there's a pretty rich intersection there. But it's still, it is, 5 or 10% of the Bitcoin community. And frankly, in that way, that's 5 or 10 or more percent of the gold community, right? Of the precious metals community. I mean, it's no accident that Alex Jones on his InfoWars shows is selling precious metals all the time, right? I mean, there's this conspiracy / precious metalism conjunction is pretty well known, and among people who look at that stuff. Why it interests me so much is that I think there is a big part of the Bitcoin community that is not interested in studying and reading, for reasons we've probably talked about before and could talk about more, and doesn't know the origins of these things. And so they are not going to talk about the Rothschild banking conspiracy, but they might talk about how the Federal Reserve is an entity that exists solely to steal wealth from people. And they may very well not know that that is just a translation of the Rothschild banking conspiracy. And that, if you go back in time and say, well, who thinks the Federal Reserve is an entity whose job it is to steal wealth from ordinary Americans? That comes out of, the exact same conspiracy theorists. In their books, it's the Rothschild bankers who are stealing money via the Federal Reserve from all normal Americans, which, by the way, in their case, actually just means rich people.
So if we're talking about 5 to 10% of those that espouse or retell that story, we might say that's true of society generally, that certain, of course, I don't have data on this, but that a certain number of people generally harbor anti-Semitic views. And I want to come back to that, but I want to take a step back and contextualize this discussion. We're chatting with Professor David Golombia of Virginia Commonwealth University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, David, you know that the show airs in Silicon Valley, but it's also a podcast, and in 10-plus years of recording shows, it has a pretty loyal following of folks that would be familiar with what Bitcoins are. But I always, always want to bring in more listeners, and particularly folks that don't focus in this area. So for people that are not as familiar, so that they're not already saying, I don't know what this guy's talking about because I don't even know what a Bitcoin is. What is your current definition of a Bitcoin? And I'll make it even a little more complex because it comes up. How does it relate to a term which I am certain people don't understand, and lots of folks, the blockchain?
You can understand Bitcoin without understanding the blockchain to a right. certain extent. So I'll start with Bitcoin and just say Bitcoin is a digital currency. It is like many, many other digital currencies that exist, most of which are very familiar to people, like dollars and yen and the euro, and each of which is typically valued in terms of the other. So A dollar might be worth 1.3 euros or something, right? And you can exchange your 1.3 euros for $1 or vice, whatever the exchange rate happens to be. And, you know, most of us hold most of our dollars or euros or yen today in completely digital environments, right? We never see the we can see it if we want to, but we never usually see the paper money. We just see an entry in a ledger. It says we have $100 in our savings account. So dollars, for the most part, are digital money today, right? In many ways, they are exclusively digital money. Bitcoin is just another, it's not money for reasons we can talk about, but it is another digital currency that is essentially entries in a ledger. That one can trade, and or one can buy things with, or hold in a savings account, or other kinds of bank-like accounts. It is outside of the ordinary banking system, and that means both that it is outside of limits imposed by the banking system, and outside of protections offered by the banking system, so that. There are some things called anti-money laundering laws, which are both in the U.S. and worldwide, that say, you know, if you want to transfer more than 10,000 U.S. dollars from a U.S. bank to somebody else, that has to be recorded and some special work has to be done at the bank to authorize that. Can be transferred immediately all over the world, and there's no authority to look over it. And this is certainly extolled as a kind of freedom by Bitcoin advocates who say, thank God we can get past those anti-money laundering laws. Those of us who might think there's a benefit to anti-money laundering laws might think that that's a problem rather than a good thing. So let's say, I want to say one other thing about Bitcoin, which is that it is touted as a currency. That is, its cryptocurrency is the class of things that it belongs to. There's 100 other cryptocurrencies or more that are widely traded. And a currency is mostly used for buying and selling things. And that is one of the things we know Bitcoin for. Certainly the most famous use of Bitcoin is on the drug and other illegal product markets on the dark net, the most famous of which was the Silk Road that was run by a guy named Ross Ulbricht, who was recently convicted of drug trafficking and a lot of other things involved with, and possibly soliciting murder, as the kingpin of the Silk Road. So buying and selling is a major feature of currency. A secondary feature of currency that is much less known to the public is using currency as an investment, right? You can, if I happen to think that that England is going to, its economy is going to just outdo the US's for a period of time, I could put my dollars into the pound, and you'd have to have a lot of money to do this, right? But there might be a differential in the way that the two currencies moved against each other, and I might make some money by having stored my money in the pound rather than the dollar, and then eventually I could sell it back to the dollar, and I'd have more than if I just kept my money in dollars. That is usually something that is done by very, very high net worth people, because the margins on it are usually very, very small. You're talking about, maybe one economy is going to exceed another by 0.5% or maybe 1% over a long period of time. And for most people, that's not enough money to make a difference. But Bitcoin, for a lot of reasons we can talk about, has enormous price swings, absolutely huge, right? And as I mentioned earlier, it became kind of better known in the world because it went from being essentially worthless, and I'll talk about that in a minute, where it comes from, to being worth over $1,000, right? So right. Depending on when you bought in, that could be a gain of unbelievable amounts, right? About 10,000%, 100,000%. If you put a dollar into it, you could have $100,000 back, which is insane, mm-hmm. right? And part of what is so interesting about the Bitcoin discourse is that these two things are in competition. Bitcoin promoters will often look at its rise in price and say that this is proof of its utility as a currency, And in fact, this is happening right now, right? In fact, Bitcoin very recently hit a new all-time high of around $2,400 or $2,500. And of course, this made all the Bitcoin websites and Twitters and everything say, look, this thing is exploding. It's, you know, it is whatever they think success is, it's reaching success. And something I talk about a fair amount in the book is that there's a real rhetorical tension between that and the claim that Bitcoin is currency. And part of the conspiracy theory versions of money is that the U.S. dollar does not maintain its value, which is for the most part wrong, but that is what the gold people and the Rothschild banking people and so forth will claim, that the dollar is constantly being devalued because it moves so much in price. And yet, Bitcoin moves so much more than the dollar has ever moved that it isn't even in the same ballpark, right? I mean, something that moves 10,000% is not stable. Even if that is a positive movement for you, that is not stability. Stability means it doesn't move at all over a period of time, or it moves 0.1%. Moving 10,000% is terrible. And when it moves 10,000% up, it can move minus 5,000% down, which has also happened to Bitcoin repeatedly. And it's interesting, it sort of reveals to me an ideological tension that it's very hard to get Bitcoin promoters to acknowledge that these two things can't go together, that you can't have a super successful investment that is at the same time a stable value-preserving currency. These two things don't work together. But this is part of what is interesting, right? Bitcoin is sold as a currency, but I think most people who look at it think that the real promoters of it are people who are looking at it as a get-rich-quick scheme. And part of what is disturbing about that is that because it is outside of all regulation, all banking regulation, all investment banking regulation, all market regulation, and there aren't that many Bitcoin in existence, it is very easy for sophisticated market makers to manipulate this market, right? By buying a whole bunch of them so that the supply goes down and then dumping a whole bunch of them, right? Pump and dump, familiar phrase in the bad parts of Wall Street, how you manipulate markets in unregulated securities, which is really what Bitcoin has become. Let me just talk for a minute about the blockchain.
Thank you.
Blockchain is the technology out of which Bitcoin is built. It's like a model of it's a kind of software. All the other cryptocurrencies are also built on their own blockchains. It is possible to build other kinds of things, not just currency equivalents on the blockchain. The idea, the blockchain is like a database. That's the easiest way to think about it. It's just a bunch of entries in a table. But instead of sitting on any one computer or even any one big machine up in the cloud, or one central location like at Facebook or at Google, the pieces of that blockchain are distributed all over the world to anybody who wants to run some particular software on their computer. So that the Bitcoin blockchain, the one on which Bitcoin exists, runs on millions of machines, or at least hundreds of thousands of machines all over the world that are constantly engaging with the transactions on the blockchain to make sure that they are real, and they are to some extent rewarded for doing that work by generating more Bitcoin. And that process is called mining, and you can see a parallel with gold there in the language. And that's how you could have gotten the original Bitcoin essentially for nothing, because back in the early days you could run this software on a very low-powered machine and generate Bitcoin for yourself. And if you've done that, as some people did, you could be a very wealthy person today. And because of that way that the software is spread out over machines all over the world, you see very important digital keywords used a lot, like decentralized and democratized. In another context, I'd love to talk about those words more, but part of what is interesting about the Bitcoin example is that for technical reasons, they had to make these operations more and more difficult over time, And so what happened was, originally, basically, you could run the Bitcoin software on any computer you wanted, but over time, you had to devote more and more powerful machines to it. And today, people think that a substantial amount of Bitcoin mining is done in super big server farms in China, in particular. Something like 60 or 70% of all Bitcoin mining is done, you know, in server farms that no individual would be able to even to think about owning. And it is ironic, but I think it fits politically and politically economically very well that this claim that this thing is decentralized turns into an incredible concentration of power among people who can afford to throw the most money and hardware at the problem. And to me, that is a defect in all like libertarian influence thinking, that it sort of sounds like it's talking about distributing power among everyone, but really it's removing all the constraints that prevent power from being concentrated. And what you end up is getting, if anything, far more concentrated power than you had under the supposedly, you know, non-distributed political regime.
We're chatting with David Galumbia of Virginia Commonwealth University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU, and I will say that I don't know that KZSU accepts Bitcoin, although it might, but you can make a donation by emailing our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or by going to our webpage and clicking on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope they continue to listen to the show. David, you started there talking about something I want to get into a little more detail to further understand this critique. You argue, and you have been, this is not the only place where you've made this argument, you've been a pretty, I think, vocal critic of cyber-libertarianism, which you started referring to, and you talk about it a bit in the book. Again, for those that are less familiar, what is cyber-libertarianism, and how does the cyber-libertarian, not even rhetoric, but really philosophy, manifest itself as right-wing extremism with Bitcoin?
Right. Well, so cyber-libertarianism is a word that was developed by a few scholars in the late 1990s to describe what was going on in Silicon Valley. The most familiar exponent of the view is John Perry Barlow's famous Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace. The important thing about cyber-libertarianism is that it is not, or at least not only, the presence of people who would identify as political libertarians in Silicon Valley, of which there are many, right? There are a lot of people who overtly say, I'm a libertarian, Travis Kalanick, Jimmy Wales, a lot of people who are famous in Silicon Valley, which is one thing, and, you know, I don't happen to agree with that philosophy, and, you know, it's okay to argue with it. But what is of more concern to me, and what cyber-libertarianism as a framework is meant to point out, is that a lot of people who don't think that they subscribe to libertarian worldview have a lot of deep philosophical presuppositions that actually come out of a libertarian worldview. And someone who actually kind of endorses this philosophy, who I believe I quote in the book, says that the core of cyber-libertarianism is the view that government should not regulate the internet, or must not or cannot regulate the internet, right? And a lot of people, you know, and I find this in my classes, right? A lot of people who go along with that statement, like, yes, of course, that's true. Government should not regulate the internet, might be Democrats, right? They might vote for Hillary Clinton, whatever, but they have this core belief that government should not regulate the internet. And then you ask, why? Why should government not regulate the internet as opposed to everything else that government does regulate? What is it about the internet that makes it special or different? Well, of course, there's often very little content to that belief. It just turns out that there's this place that government doesn't apply, right? And that's also in John Perry Barlow's declaration. And it's a really strange and crazy belief. I mean, especially when you see that it's promoted by people who will say, on the one hand, the internet and computers have infiltrated their way into every part of our lives, There is nothing we do today that isn't impacted by the internet and computers more generally, right? And on the other hand, government should not regulate it. So that very quickly turns from what looks like a limited claim that government shouldn't regulate whatever the internet is to government should not regulate anything that takes place on the computer, and everything takes place on the computer. And all of a sudden, you have an argument that is basically government should not exist. And that Venn diagram thing, right? The 10% of people who will overtly say, like, government should not exist, like, you know, we can argue with them, but there's a much larger group of people who don't think that they're libertarians, but who do think government should not regulate the internet as a really strong, like, gut feeling. And yet, which serves some really good political purposes for people who want to gin up support for certain causes and things, but it really doesn't have very much content. It's not a very coherent view, and is promoted by, you know, the largest internet companies who have a really strong vested interest in preventing government from regulating them. So Google is a major proponent of what they call internet freedom, right? And the internet freedom is which sounds great. A lot of people think it's like a civil rights cause, but to me, it is an anti-civil rights cause. It is a way of preventing rights protections from interfering with what certain very large corporations want to do.
David, how do we see this rhetoric translated, and I think you just started mentioning it, translated into tangible outputs? So can you give us a couple examples of where you see this language, and you've alluded to it before, maybe this comes back to a couple of topics you wanted to return to. How does this problem translate itself on the ground for those maybe that don't even own Bitcoin?
I mean, the best examples I have are not going to really be about Bitcoin, but right.
Which I think is kind of the point. So yeah.
Yeah. One of the most visible examples is when you look at Google and Facebook and how they interact with the EU, right? Google and Facebook are both American companies, and they have worked very hard to structure American law in their favor, so that, you know, there's a lot of free speech defenses of what Google and Facebook do, as if the freedom of expression in the First Amendment is meant primarily to prevent any kind of regulation of Google and Facebook, which is another whole argument we talk about another time. And when the EU, which has much stronger privacy protections for individuals than the US does, tries to assert its right to care about the privacy of its own citizens, Google and Facebook immediately trot out this internet freedom rhetoric, and how dare the EU interfere with the primary freedom, which is Google and Facebook's right to do whatever they want. And the rhetoric that they throw up about these things is remarkable in itself, because it is so dismissive of democratic governance. It is just, it's dismissive of political sovereignty, in that it appears to be unaware that the EU itself and the countries of the EU have different ways of approaching free speech than the US does, which has a uniquely absolutist take on the matter. And it's dismissive of the very fact that the EU, that people in the EU are very concerned about privacy. And they have concepts that are completely foreign to us, like the dignity of the person. And they would like the dignity of the person to be something that is deeply protected, and therefore setting up secret files on every person who, in existence, whether or not they use Facebook, which is something Facebook does, is a little bit offensive to that idea of dignity. And a very concrete example is in this little piece of jurisprudence called the right to be, which is popularly called the right to be forgotten, right? Which is a decision that was made in the EU where Google was made to remove search results on defamatory or in some way negative information about a person who has filed a lawsuit and gone through all these measures to say that the information should be removed. And whether or not you agree with the right to be forgotten decision itself, it's a complicated decision. the rhetoric Google was able to marshal against it was that this was some terrible, terrible, terrible offense against freedom. And it's one thing for Google to say that, but there were very few people in the United States in general, including digital advocates and legal advocates and so on, who were able even to say, like, hold on a minute, this is a democratic polity that has made a decision about a fundamental right, and maybe we should not talk about it as if it is just completely beyond the pale and, you know, offensive to everything we hold dear for a country to say, like, privacy is important to us and, you know, Google standards in the United States maybe shouldn't apply over here in Germany and France and so on. There's a lot of other issues like that, but that one happens to be especially clear because it seems like when you frame it that way, like, and it is about a regulatory power over the internet, right? That the EU is asserting we have a right and a duty to regulate certain things that happen here. And rather than sort of engage with the issue, Google just kind of says, no, you don't. Nobody has a right to regulate us.
So that kind of gets us into an area which I think is worth exploring as well, which I think is manifested quite nicely, or at least there's an argument for it with regard to Bitcoin. We increasingly, particularly folks that focus on the internet and folks that focus on how we can perfect decision making and outputs, many people have made the argument historically that computers are the way to solve problems of human imperfection and human subjectivity and so forth. And one of the you identify several, as you call them, pillars of extremist thought that that you believe the Bitcoin or some Bitcoin proponents rely upon. And one of them is one that I want to ask you about in a little more detail. You make the argument that, and I'll just quote from your book, a third pillar of extremist thought we regularly find in Bitcoin circles is less specific to Bitcoin, but more endemic in the digital world among cyberpunks, crypto anarchists, and other advocates of nebulous digital causes like internet freedom, which is, you know, the context, the broader context of your book. That is, you write, this is the presumption that computer-based expertise trumps that of all other forms of expertise, sometimes because everything in the world is ultimately reducible to computational processes. And you've defined that previously in your work as computationalism. Can you talk a bit more about that? Because I think that that's a really important inflection point that we face today as we're seeing the limitations of computers. And I, you know, the example that I use is the problems associated, excuse me, with autonomous cars and Uber's use of them in particular. But can you expand upon that? How does this this presumption of computer-based expertise trumping all other forms of expertise, as you write, manifests itself here?
Boy, I mean, that is in Bitcoin in particular, right? It manifests in some of the things we've already been talking about, in the sense that if you try to talk to Bitcoin people about how finance works, which is a pretty well understood area with a lot of people who have worked on it both out of self-interest and out of academic interest for a long time, you know, they are really prone to say, well, Bitcoin is the perfection of finance and of money and currency and so forth, and it doesn't work anything like all these other things you say, right? So if you say to them, well, Bitcoin is a completely unregulated currency that people like the Winklevoss twins and other investors even can step in and corner the market on and make it go through pump and dump cycles like any other unregulated security in history, they'll say, oh no, right? Bitcoin is perfect and it's eventually going to stabilize. And then you say, why? What principle is it that tells you it's going to stabilize? Well, they have no answer. And then you say, well, let's look at, you know, show me another financial instrument that works that way. And by the way, we could even back up a little bit more, right? Because a lot of Bitcoin rhetoric and even the software itself is based on some presumptions about how commodities work. This is, you know, baked into conspiracy theory is the view that the limited supply of commodities is what makes them valuable. Gold is valuable because there's only a certain amount, even though you can always mine a little bit more. But the fact that there's only a limited amount means that it will always go up in value. Now ask one of those people to go and show you a chart of another commodity in history that has that's been limited in value that has only ever gone up. Right? Well, then all of a sudden, that principle that they said they espoused, right, turns out to not be a principle, because in fact, if you look at gold or silver or platinum or palladium or diamonds, right, they all swing in value up and down. Like, the, actually, the supply does not really correlate to the question of growth in value. And furthermore, you know, ordinary stocks are limited in value, right? And we're all familiar with the fact that ordinary stocks, which are in some way even tied to the health of the company underlying them, they go up and down in value, right? The limited supply doesn't actually have much to do with the value of the security. And to sort of to widen the scope a little bit here, it is a big concern to me that so many people in the computer world and in Silicon Valley in particular have gotten the twin ideas both that expertise in computers is expertise in everything and trumps expertise in everything, and also that their mission is to save the world, right? And you know, Fred Turner's scholarship on the Whole Earth catalog and Stuart Brand and the Whole Earth electronic community list, the well, right? And how the sort of within Silicon Valley itself, this conjunction of kind of saving the world mixed with computerizing came together is really fascinating and really disturbing. And, you know, I and a few of my friends, some of whom you've had on the show, right, when we spar with some of these people on Twitter, and they say they're saving the world with something, with one of their new technologies, and then you ask them, well, what do you know about that place? You know, Bitcoin, for example, is often, you know, if we, when I criticize Bitcoin, something I get sometimes is, well, you hate people, you hate poor people in Africa. You know, and you might think that that is, as I did the first time I saw it, I was like, well, I never mentioned poor people or Africa or anything like that, right? And they have developed this idea that, like, well, my computer expertise trumps all banking and finance expertise, and I can tell in my somewhat condescending way that the poor people, quote unquote, poor people in Africa need this special solution. And if you start to ask them what they know about Africa and what they know about poverty, it turns out they know very little about it. What they know about the history of trying to help people in Africa, you know, scholars like, I mean, people who've done it like Jeffrey Sachs and scholars who've been critical of it like William Easterly, they don't read any of that material. They don't need to read it because the computer is all they need to know. And, you know, it's just that it verges on a kind of proto-fascism in that, you know, which I realize is kind of an extreme thing to say, but this sort of privileging of one kind of productive labor over any other kind of labor or knowledge is that it creates the sense that there's an in-group and an out-group, and the in-group gets to decide who is in the in-group and everybody else is on the out-group. And if you look at how a lot of these developers conduct themselves, that is really what they do, right? They're judging people all the time on their judgment of whether people are or are not technically savvy enough to be allowed to participate in the conversation. Just on a side note, one group of people who is not allowed to participate, of course, is politicians and judges, because they lack the requisite technical expertise. They don't know how to code. And, you know, I've gotten into arguments with people like that where they're like, well, the Supreme Court shouldn't be issuing judgments about programming related matters because they aren't programmers. And then if you say, well, should they be issuing judgments about healthcare related matters given that they're not doctors? Mm-hmm. You know, they have no real answer to that, right? Because they haven't thought that through. But of course, we know that's false. Judges are supposed to be expert in judgment and law. And, you know, of course, they should ask experts in other fields. But, you know, the idea that, like, judging is not an expertise or an area of, you know, study is really disturbing.
We're chatting with Professor David Galumbia of Virginia Commonwealth University, author of the book The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. David, I'm getting to the familiar, unfair portion of the show. where I started asking you questions that you don't have time to fully answer, because we have about 10 minutes left, 9 minutes. So let me ask you a couple of kind of, broader where are we questions. As I mentioned in the introduction, we're recording on May 31st, 2017. Overnight, the president tweeted something unintelligible around midnight, a few minutes after midnight, that caused that the New York Times picked up on, and that the world ultimately knows about. We have people like Steve Bannon in the White House. We've got a rise of right-wing extremism that seems quite clear and quite apparent within the executive branch, and it manifests itself in Congress, which in large measure doesn't seem terribly interested in reining that in. Putting aside the politics of all that, I think we can put it aside. Where do you see us now, given that you published this book prior to the election? Do you find that where we stand today, May 31st, 2017, which of course could change tomorrow, in any way is underscoring the points that you're making? Do you see a difference in terms of these kinds of issues coming out of the White House versus what you've seen as the rhetoric and the action of entities that push right-wing thinking in the context of Bitcoin?
What I guess I will say is, I've been thinking and writing about this stuff for quite a while, and people used to push back on me so much and use some pretty disparaging terms even to evaluate my thoughts that, I started to rein myself in a little bit and think like, oh, maybe I'm going too far. I'm a little bit too paranoid. I like to read science fiction, so maybe I can develop these scenarios in my head pretty easily. But frankly, the world has so overtaken what my fears were, even as I was finishing this book, right? I mean, I was writing this book, finishing it like last spring, and, Trump hadn't even been nominated yet. And I was like, how far should I go? And, even by the time the book came out, I was like, the world has bypassed what I thought was happening here. And, it's part of what really worries me is that there's no necessary connection really between Trump or Bannon and Bitcoin. You don't see them necessarily promoting them, although you do see some very extreme Trump supporters being very, very hardline Bitcoin advocates in a way you don't really necessarily see Bernie Sanders supporters or Hillary Clinton supporters being quite so tied into Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. But you do see this, part of how, in my opinion, Trump was able to get elected was by this spreading of very, very strong right-wing, partly racist, partly very xenophobic, even if it is sort of masked, partly very distrustful of government as an idea. All this discourse together really helped to make it possible to elect somebody who in many ways has contempt for the very, the idea of democratic governance. This has been my worry all along, right? Not so much that there's a direct line between Silicon Valley cyber libertarianism and the election of somebody like Eric Schmidt or something like that as president, but that the space of what has become acceptable to talk about and what is taken as background obvious information has shifted so much that it becomes very difficult for those of us with contrary beliefs even to get much traction.
So that kind of leads us. I'm sorry, I thought you were continuing there. So that kind of leads us to a few closing questions on that point. You have raised, I think, issues that are, to put it mildly, uncomfortable for many people in the technology law and technology policy world to confront. And I'm curious about, and you've alluded to it, but perhaps you could share with listeners your experience in raising these issues. In other words, do you find that folks are willing to engage you on, you know, on these topics, which again are controversial. Again, I don't mean that to suggest that you lack evidence for it, but controversial because again, you know, part of the utopian version of the internet and technology is that idea of free and open discourse, which of course has been challenged repeatedly in everywhere from copyright policy to, as you mentioned, the right to be forgotten. What's been your experience, and if you have about 5 minutes on this, what's been your experience in bringing up these extremely challenging issues amongst folks that are not espousing these views?
Right. I have a very ambivalent reaction to this because, you know, on the one hand, thanks to social media in particular, I have been able to spread these views to some extent, and I have, and they've been taken up by students and colleagues, and I have met some absolutely wonderful people who are at the very least willing to, like, take my work seriously, and sometimes I collaborate with them. Quite a few of the people who are on your show I've worked with and talked to, and, that is wonderful, right? It's hard to turn away from that. But at the same time, and this has happened with Bitcoin too, right? There are a few people in the Bitcoin community have contacted me since my book came out and have been really supportive. And, but we've had to have sort of back channel communications because the majority of communications are absolutely awful, right? They are not reasonable engagements with the ideas, and to my sorrow, some of this comes from other scholars, even in my field, who just immediately turn to invective and ad hominem and insults and piling on with bots and doxing and all the crazy stuff they do to try to shut you down, right? And it's, to me, that goes back to this general principle that you mentioned yourself, right? That this view that everything must be free and open and there must be no regulation of it whatsoever, that there's a lot to say about that. But one of the effects of that is to concentrate power in people who are willing to abuse it. And that's why, quite a few people have said, we look at Trump's use of Twitter, right? He has a rhetorical power. He's willing to sort of abuse the public space through the use of emotion and other things in a way that a lot of people with maybe more the kind of perspective that I would agree with more are not willing to do because they see it as a kind of abuse and they do not want to abuse other people. And the view that sort of absolute unregulation is going to produce absolute equality, I think, is just manifestly and provably and empirically false. That isn't the way things work. When you remove all regulation of how people behave, what happens is the people who behave the worst step in and kind of crowd everybody else out. And, the fact that I'm saying this even, like, this is a fundamental principle of like, deep democratic theory that we've been having at least since Aristotle and Plato. Like, this isn't some new knowledge that I've come up with. And the fact that we're sort of having to argue about it now and arguing that kind of, as we would see among some of the cyber-libertarian people, like, the most anti-democratic thing is to have a democratically elected government. You just wonder who in history, John Locke, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, could you go up to and say, well, the real enemy of democracy is the democratic government.
Right.
Like, right? That is, we worked hard and fought hard and people died to create this thing. It's not anti-democratic. It is the best version we have of democracy. And tearing it apart is not the way to get to more democracy.
And, that's actually a topic for the guest that's coming up next week, Al Roberts, who's written a book called Four Crises of American Democracy, Representation, Mastery, Discipline, and Anticipation. And it's a good way to, good in the sense that in our discussion is a good way to close. It's a rough way to close. I do want to ask you if in one more minute, because you're always working on interesting projects, what are you focusing on? You alluded to it earlier right now, and what can we look for in the coming weeks and months?
This Bitcoin book is a small book, and it is meant to be, it was sort of written as a chapter of a longer book on cyber-libertarianism, and that is what I'm working on now, and where I'm trying to trace out some of these larger themes and get into how this plays out in a variety of spheres, not just Bitcoin. And I hope to have it done by the end of the summer, but we'll see how that goes.
Yes, I have many projects that I want to end at the end of the summers, and I end a fair amount of them, but never as much as I would like. Professor David Galumbia, author of the book The Politics of Bitcoin: Software as Right-Wing Extremism, thank you so much for joining us today on the show, David. I'm a fan of your work, and I really appreciate and commend you for taking on these hard topics and a fair amount of received wisdom in broader, particularly academic technology circles. But I look forward to having you on the show once you are comfortable having the discussion regarding your broader book. And otherwise, thank you and have a productive summer.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. So I have a number of guests coming up over the next several weeks and really through the summer. As I'm going to be doing, as I've done in the past, I take some of the summer and I'm not recording new shows, but I have shows that will appear periodically over the next few months. As I just mentioned, coming up next week is Professor Al Roberts, author of the book The Four Crises of American Democracy: Representation, Mastery, Discipline, and Anticipation. Additionally, Professor Ramesh Srinivasan, author of the book Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. Jennifer Granick, author of the book American Spies, and others will be coming on in the next few months. As always, you have a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show this quarter live Fridays at 2 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU, and you can also stream it via the internet at KZSU live.stanford.edu. You can get the show via podcast by going to the Hearsay Culture webpage, by going to iTunes, and at this point, I think all of the major podcast streaming apps. And always, you can reach out to me through a contact form at hearsayculture.com or by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you so much for joining me today on the show, and I'm really happy to be back. Stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.